Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming up on this week's show, how to never lose a retro file again.
Played a Resident Evil text adventure.
And we chat with Bruce Shelley about Railroad Tycoon, Civilization, and Age of Empires.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every weekend with our good mates at Bitmap Books. Now, you may have heard that the Commodore 64 celebrated its 40th birthday recently. And one of their books you need to check out, reprints are due next month, of Commodore 64, A Visual Compendium. Discover the massive library of games that made the Commodore 64 into the most popular home computer of the 1980s. Check that out and the rest of their retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.com. And with our amazing friends at PCB Way. Now, they offer a fully featured custom PCB prototype service with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and they offer additional services, including 3D printing, injection molding, and they're massive supporters of the retro community. So you can get an instant quote for your project right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 349, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And fantastic to have you joining us for another hour-ish of completely nerding out about all things retro, reminiscing about the golden age of video games, and of course, bringing you up to speed on all the happenings in the world of retro from over the last 7 days. And hopefully Ravi and I are not sounding too hoarse this week after a rather eventful weekend in Germany, where we're out there for Amiga 37, that I've got to say, I think was the best retro show. And I know there's some serious competition. I've been to so many incredible shows, but this was definitely up there, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a really good event. I think there was around over 1,000 people, definitely. And there were some pretty cool announcements as well. So Amiga announced that they're actually going to be working with Evercade to bring some Amiga titles to the Evercade. So that's probably going to be a story that will be coming up in the next few weeks. Yeah, it was a really awesome event. I did a bit of DJing. Dan had his back... his cap on backwards and looked like Bart Simpson was dancing around. Yeah, it was really good fun.
Dan was being tubular.
It was because during the day, I mean, I only went on the Saturday, but we went out on the Friday night for a bit. It was reasonably sensible. I think home for about 1 a.m. and obviously with the time difference, you know, that's like midnight UK time. We kept telling ourselves that. Then Saturday, went to the show. The thing is, I only brought hand luggage and I packed it pretty much right to the top intentionally because I thought, well, if I do that, I can't spend too much money. Mm-hmm. So I did only buy a couple of things at the show. Now, there's a game, I don't know if you're familiar with it, Joe, Frontier Elite 2.
I've heard of it, yeah.
That was the one you tried to play, Joe.
I've tried to play
it. Got really confused at, yeah. You were playing Elite.
Was that? Yeah, you played the original, I think, didn't you, when we did the game suggestions
I didn't. I don't think I reviewed that one in the end, though, did I? Because I couldn't even, like, start the game. Yeah.
Well, that's been my experience with it as well, because I had a demo of the game back in the day, and I've always wanted to know how to play it. And there are YouTube playthroughs and stuff like that, but I've always thought, well, you know, 30 years I've been saying this now, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to actually learn how to play this game, because I've heard it's incredible, it looks really good. And I saw a box copy of it at the Amiga show. Manual included, star charts and everything, €20.
You need that manual, thought, right, okay. Definitely.
You do. You need. That's why I thought I've got the manual next to me. I can sit down at my Amiga 1200, you know, cup of tea, get the manual open. I can finally, after 30 years, learn how to play Frontier Elite 2. Only thing is, eventually realised when I left the show, the manual was in there, but of course, the manual was in German.
Nice, good move, Dan.
Didn't think about that one, did you? Yep.
Nope, so I think I'm going to have to learn German now.
Yeah.
Before I can play Frontier Elite 2. So I've got about 30 years maybe to learn German.
Okay, what's the reason for you learning German with like a private tutor? And you're like, so I can play Elite.
So I didn't get many pickups over the weekend, but that was one. I mean, it looks nice in the box anyway. Then ended up at Ravi's DJ gig in a club where there's a load of Amiga nerds all together, literally taking over a proper underground nightclub. There was Ravi and Hoffman on the decks till about 3 a.m. And then I sat with an Amiga engineer, Dave Haney, in a bar over the road till about 5 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. So in all, brilliant weekend. Still slightly feeling it now on Wednesday, but it was definitely worth it. So if you're out there over the weekend, we did bump into loads of listeners and YouTube viewers as well. So it was fantastic to meet you there. Roll on next year. But of course, it is business as usual on the podcast this week. And we do have another legendary guest to bring you on the show in just a bit. And this week, you are in your element here, Ravi.
Oh, yes. This is Bruce Shelley. Now, Bruce was named by PC Gamer magazine as one of the 25 gamer gods. So, you know, PC gaming, Bruce is just absolutely amazing. He basically started with Avalon Hill. And that was a company that started, you know, board games and turning board games into video games. So that kind of crossover from board game to video game really happened with games like Railroad Tycoon as well, which was one of Bruce's first titles, and you know how big that series is nowadays. And then he went on to work with Sid Meier on a small game called Civilization.
Never heard of that one.
that got like worldwide fame, absolutely amazing one. Then he kind of went out of the video games industry, started making strategy books about games, but then entered with a tour de force that was Age of the Empires series, which is very like Civilization, but in real time. So, you know, Civilization is a kind of turn-based game.
I grew up on Age of Empires. Like, I absolutely adored it. It was like the only game we had on our PC. And I absolutely loved Age of Empires 1 and 2. So, absolutely loving this one.
Oh, it's a great game. And, you know, Microsoft took that on. And that was one of the titles that actually kind of led people to believe, you know, oh, Microsoft are quite good at gaming and stuff. And it really, like... bought their PC division into good repute. So having Bruce on is just something I've wanted to have since the start of the podcast. And like, you know, my kind of strategy senses are tingling in this one, definitely.
Yeah, this is an absolutely huge interview. So make sure you hang around for that. Bruce Shelley, our special guest, he'll be on the show in around half an hour from now. But of course, before we do that, we always like to bring you up to speed and have a bit of a chat about what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last week. You know, you've been on this a bit of a tip recently, Joe, of kind of playing retro titles in modern tech.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about how you've been playing kind of retro games in virtual reality on your Oculus and stuff like that. What about this for something that goes completely the other way? And I've got to give a shout to Ash, who linked us this story in our Discord. It is literally just a tweet at the moment. Actually, I think it was posted on the Facebook group, that someone... this is Mark Watson, is actually making a text adventure version, a text-only game of Resident Evil 1.
Yeah, you guys have forwarded this over to me to give it a bash. I really, really, really want to be really arrogant and just be like, yeah, I'll complete this in 5 minutes. Because I know everything about Resident Evil, I would claim. But yeah, I do not know everything about text adventure games, so I might get stuck in the first room. But I am really excited to sign up for this one and give it a try. This looks very unique. And as you say, kind of the opposite to what I've been doing recently. But obviously, Resident Evil, my favorite game series of all time. So I'm pretty excited to give this a try and kind of let you guys know how I got on taking it really old school.
Would that be your first kind of text adventure experience, Joe?
I've screwed around on them, you know, as a kid, like on a friend's dad's PC when he's gone, try this out. And we've literally like, you wake up in a bed and we're like, get up. And it's just like, error. Do you know what I mean?
Like, you have to write wake up instead.
Yeah. So, and then there was, is it Black Ops 1? Call of Duty Black Ops 1. Had a hidden game in it. On the start menu, you're like tied to a chair. Yeah. And if you, was it the triggers? If you press the triggers over and over again, you would break out the chair. You could move around the room, and it was I forget the name of the game, but it was on the computer terminal. And I remember screwing around on that and getting like maybe 3 or 4 answers into the game before it was just like error kind of thing. So this
wasn't
it
Zork, I think was
Zork,
in there, wasn't
that's
it?
I think, yeah, Zork. Yeah, I wasn't to say Zool, but I was like, it's not Zool, it's not Chupa Chumps, it's not Gremlins. Hopefully I'll have the credentials to become a tester for this. So I'm going to be signing up to that tonight, and hopefully I can let everybody know how I got on with it.
I can just imagine Zool the text adventure. It's just like collect sweet, collect cake.
Yeah, Chupa Chump, Chupa Chump.
So at the moment, he's only looking for a couple of game testers by the sounds of it. But he said, knowledge of the original game not needed. But you can email him at mark@dinkylittlewebsites.co.uk. I'll put a link to the original post in our show notes as well. So if you find a Resident Evil 1, you want to play the text adventure version of it, this looks really interesting. So you can read more about that in our show notes. Now, while we're speaking of games that have kind of been changed and running on different platforms and being reinterpreted, were you a fan of Perfect Dark, Joe? I imagine, you know, you loved GoldenEye 007. Were you into the kind of spiritual successor to it?
Yeah, I didn't have Perfect Dark, so I didn't play it until much later on when it actually came out on the Rare Replay Collection, where you got Perfect Dark rather than GoldenEye, famously. But a lot of my friends had Perfect Dark and really, really enjoyed it. They all, you know, screamed and shouted about it being like the successor to GoldenEye, and you know, some would say better than GoldenEye because it did everything GoldenEye did, but more. You know, it used the same game engine, but there was more guns, there was more sci-fi to it, there was more levels, so it was more of the same. So I always enjoyed it when I played it. But yeah, this is quite interesting. So it's been decompiled, hasn't it? So somebody's ripped it apart.
They've kind of reversed engineered it. So This is it's kind of like a legal route around it, but as we've seen from previous reversed engineered projects, it can add to some like kind of, you know, put them in a bad situation. So the last reversed engineered program was the one that was GTA, and that, you know, seemed fully legal because they're not using any of the code. They've kind of reversed engineered it themselves and they've rebuilt the game. But then Take-Two Interactive took them to court, and that's been removed, all traces of it off the internet. So this is a kind of interesting world of the reversed engineered game. It's got none of the original assets. It's got none of the original stuff, but, you know, it still might be something that the games companies don't like, especially Nintendo as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if this would, like, obviously it was on the Nintendo 64. And it is the NTSC versions of the N64 games they've decompiled. Obviously, Rare now, it was a Rare property that now is owned by Microsoft. So I don't know who would, if it would be the house of Nintendo or Microsoft, who might come after the guy who's done this. But it's cool. So the guy who's done this, like you say, he's completely reverse engineered it. It says it's been reverse engineered down to 97%, but it's more of a technicality because of there's some reused assets and reused codings in there. And, you know, the system he's done it on doesn't quite understand that they're separate codes or separate assets. So it says it's 97%. But the reason this is exciting is, you know, we could just go, oh, somebody's decompiled the game. But as you say, Ravi, about GTA, and also famously, they did it with Super Mario 64 and Zelda Ocarina of Time. This means these games can now be ported to PC, which never were ported before. They were only on the N64 or on compilations. Mm. And that allows, as Ravi says, for them to get the original assets and make them high res, you know, change them, make them better, make them worse or whatever. Play around with the game and essentially mod and port it to PC. And obviously, as you say, Dan, it was a famous game, a well-loved game. So it kind of opens up that world of opportunity for people to have a play around with it, obviously, unless it gets shut down. Obviously, a lot of these things end up in certain areas of the internet and stuff like that for people to get a hold of. So I think it's only going to be a matter of time before we're going to start seeing some, or we're going to start reporting on, you know, like super HD mods of Perfect Dark, or, you know, like perfect ports of the game and stuff like that. And it just opens up that world.
I think they've been really clever with this as well, because it is technically legal because he hasn't used any original assets.
Yeah.
He's pretty much decompiled it, looked at it, recreated it with his own code.
Yeah, that was the Same with GTA as well. You had to use an original copy to kind of add those certain things in there. But
I mean, to be fair, if Microsoft's lawyers came to me and I had a fan project, I probably wouldn't challenge it. I'd be like, yeah, I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it's more like they've got the bigger clout in that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, legally it's probably on your side, but, you know, they'll just take you down.
It begs that question of, you know, we're here covering it. Nintendo Life have covered it. VGC have covered it. It begs that question. Do these people actually want it covering and blowing up like that?
Yeah.
But I guess
what are you talking about it, you buggers?
Yeah, but I guess they wouldn't put it out there. You know, they wouldn't put it on the forums. They wouldn't put it, you know, on the pages and stuff like that if they didn't want people to go and have a look at it.
Well, what I think is, what I think is someone needs to do this with a lot of money and then there'll be a landmark case where they kind of win it and then they go, okay, reverse engineering's all right. And then they can go, in the case of blah, blah, blah versus blah, 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 this happened and it set a precedent.
and then everybody just starts doing it, don't they?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, there's that thing, isn't there, that famously the Barbara Streisand effect, where the more you try and get something taken off the internet, the farther it spreads. So there's always ways to find them, even if they get taken down. But it is very cool. And I think just opening up games like that that were limited to one platform and giving you an enhanced experience, I think, is really cool. If you ever want to play Perfect Dark and didn't have an N64, it could be a good way to play it on your PC, upscaled. Now, this next story, I've got to say, when I read this headline, this just sounds like something out of science fiction. And I still don't quite understand how this is possible. But this is a video that is apparently showing brain cells in a Petri dish playing Pong.
This is fascinating. And also a little bit terrifying for me. I'm hoping, you know, Dr. Ravi might be able to speculate on it a little bit more and clear a few things up for me because I'm
a resident biologist.
A resident biologist. No, because Ravi's a smart one. But yeah, so the story goes, it's an incredible video showing brain cells in a Petri dish learning to play Pong. And there's a video of them playing Pong against the wall. And then there's a video of the brain cells playing Pong against each other, which is just absolutely mind-blowing. So essentially, these are living brain cells that they're using in a Petri dish, and they're using, to try and simplify it and get my head around it, and I don't want to butcher this or get it wrong, so hopefully if I do get it wrong, Ravi can correct me, or maybe even yourself.
Oh God, Dan. How come I'm the expert?
You are the expert, Dan. Ravi, you're the smart one, but they're using electrical feedback signals to essentially control the paddles on the game. And they've taught them using electricity, you know, electrical signals on how the game works. And it's all kind of linked, but separate to what Elon Musk was doing with the, the Neuralink a couple of years ago with the monkey brain, playing Pong with its brain, with its mind. And it's all to do with electrical signals, you know, from the brain, because obviously the brain, I say obviously, but the brain works in electrical signals. So it's all electrical signals controlling it. But essentially, the experiment kind of started out just to see if the brain cells were alive. And once they realized that they were alive, and this is a biotech startup, Cortical Labs, they're doing that. And it's the chief scientific officer, Brian Kagan, who's kind of released the video. And essentially what they're saying is once they realized it was alive, they wanted to teach it simple, kind of like, not logical, but like simple things for it to do. And Pong, teaching it to play a game, and Pong being like, you know, one of the first ever games, seemed like the logical thing for it to do to see if it'd be able to understand it. And it seems like it's done it pretty quick, but it's just scary because it's just like, they're human brain cells. They're human brain
cells. Well, reading this report, even they were shocked by it.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable.
Well, yeah, they're kind of created that. You were totally right, Joe. But they're not like taken from a human.
No.
They have been kind of created in the way like stem cells are done. And I think this is interesting. Obviously, totally right about the electrical signals and stuff like that. And that would be able to teach it. But this also plays into like kind of, you know, stem cells are pretty controversial. And like, are you playing God here? And so was Elon Musk's kind of project as well. It's interesting to see that video games seem to be the one logical thing that they're testing a lot of these on. Like they're testing AI and DeepMind and all of the kind of you know, the basic stuff is a basic video game. And I guess it makes sense with like electricity and stuff like that. But I think it's interesting. It's I still don't quite understand it. And I guess it could help people, you know, if you could teach basic functions to these things, you know, to react in a certain way to like the electrical signals in the brain, you could probably help recover people with brain injuries in the future.
And get other
parts of the body working with other parts that haven't worked previously or through an accident or birth or something like that. It's interesting. But then also it's really controversial as well, kind of doing this stuff. A lot of issues with this, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like you say, it's why is the research there and there's the controversy behind it and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, watching the video, the first kind of like 10, 20 seconds of it, you're like, is it actually like, okay, yeah, it's controlling it, but does it actually know what it's doing? Is it just a fluke that the ball hit where the paddle was down at the bottom? But the longer you watch it, it is obviously, it's logically trying to, it is moving to get the ball and it doesn't miss the ball. It figures out what it's doing. They've playfully named it Brain Dish.
Dish Brain,
it's called. So they have named it Dish Brain. And, you know, they're saying like this is going to really, really like fast track this kind of like research and technology and stuff like that. But that's why I say it's scary. It's kind of like you say, it's that playing God. Where do they go next? Kind of thing.
I just find the whole element of retro gaming really interesting. Like, you know, Pong being like the basic, simplest kind of one that it can do. Like, what are we going to get? Tetris next? Or,
you know,
kind of complex shapes and stuff like that. And you know, are these kind of like, you know, video games, are they going to be leading in like scientific and medical kind of, you know, discoveries? It's pretty amazing, really. I didn't think we'd be covering something like this in the news, to be honest. Wow, you know, good story, guys.
I love the fact that their next thing they're going to try with it is they're apparently going to try and teach it to play Pong while intoxicated to let them deeply observe the actions of brain cells when inebriated. Oh. So we're either going to get it drunk.
I thought you were going to say they're going to try and get it to play Space Invaders or something. Like, for me, that was the next
logical. I'm looking at this, and I don't know about you guys, but I always play Grand Theft Auto a little bit better after a couple of pints. So it will be interesting to see.
Yeah, maybe in a year's time, we'll be like, well, it's playing GTA now.
you think you play it better after a few pints.
You know, I don't know if there's any truth behind this, but they're claiming this is the first time scientists have observed something that qualifies as intelligence outside of viewing complete living beings. I don't know how big of a statement that is. I am far from a scientist. I'm a guy on a podcast, so we'll see where this goes.
Well, I for one welcome our new dish-brained overlords. So, if you wanted to see the video,
they'll probably beat you at Pong, Dan.
Yeah, he'll beat me at Pong. Look at
it. He plays better than me after a couple of drinks, I give it that. So, I'll put that video if you want to check it out. Very, very interesting. You'll find that in our show notes in your podcast app or at theretrohour.com. Now, speaking of really interesting things, one thing that I've always found fascinating is seeing things that we only saw in previews or beta versions of games that never made it into the final release. And this looks really, really impressive, actually, I've got to say. This is some modders who've recreated a Super Mario Sunshine stage from the preview Nintendo showed at Space World 2001.
Right.
Now, obviously, Super Mario Sunshine, that was, you know, the big Mario game on the GameCube, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And if you remember in that game, you had a Delfino Plaza that was kind of the middle of the game where everything kind of linked to and everything like that. But when they give a preview of this a year earlier before the game came out, I think it was actually the final ever Space World that Nintendo were at 2001.
Yeah,
but there's a completely different version of Delfino Plaza in that. And they were showing some footage on screen, but then when the game came out, it looked completely different. There was different NPCs in there as well, different enemies. But it turns out some modders have actually managed to recreate it using a mixture of kind of just watching that footage, but also checking out some of the code that's in the final release of Super Mario Sunshine.
Okay.
Now, there is a video that I'll link up in our show notes as well. It's about 7 minutes long where they go through everything they've done and how they've achieved this.
Yeah.
But in video games, you know, you have things called hype maps.
Yeah.
So these are basically code that tells the game how a character interacts with a game, you know, the areas it can stand on, that kind of thing. It turns out that the original height map for the lost Super Mario Sunshine Plaza was still in the final code.
Okay.
So you know, a couple of modders have...
A lot of this kind, you know, a lot of this kind of happens when coders just remove a section or they kind of just hide it within the game. And then you're finding like previous sections in there and stuff. And sometimes it's found by people doing glitches and stuff like that. And they'll suddenly go, oh, wow, there's this level or what was this from? And it's like, oh, it's a leftover, you know, bit of map or something. So that's really interesting that they kind of found this map there.
Yeah, and it's one guy who really started this project, a guy called Tempo, and he'd always wanted to play this kind of, you know, lost relic of Mario history. And he went digging through the code and actually kind of started to make it in Blender because they're going to be releasing a Super Mario Sunshine ROM hack, which is called Super Mario Eclipse. So what that's going to have is it's going to be a modified version of the game that will allow the player to time travel between the modern Plaza design and also the original one that was in this preview back in 2001 as well. So that's a good way of kind of tying it together. But there's also, I don't know if you've heard of an NPC character, I think he's more of an enemy actually, called Trampling Stew, who was deleted from the final version of Super Mario Sunshine. It kind of looks a bit like a large toadstool kind of stomping around. But it turned out that the textures for him and everything were also in the game. So he's managed to restore him and kind of put him back in the plaza like he was in the original preview.
Yeah.
Back in 2001. So, and you can even defeat him as well by pouring water into his head. Then he turns into an eye, then you jump on him and he turns into a coin. So there is still more work to be done, but at the moment there is a playable demo that you can download. And there's been a, you know, group of guys have got involved in this as well, because Tempo admitted that he wasn't really that good at doing textures. So there's a guy called Yoshi too. There's about five or six other contributors who've all got together to basically make this playable now. And it's going to feature in their upcoming Super Mario Sunshine ROM hack, Super Mario Eclipse. So if you want to check out the work in progress so far, and you can download it to play it as well, that is available now. So I think that's just really cool. The fact that, you know, so many people would have seen that and been excited to play that version. Then when it came out, it was completely different. It's always nice to kind of go back and check out what it would have been like.
It always happens with trade shows and stuff like that, doesn't it? It's like they kind of build the hype up with a level and then they present something totally different. And like people were like, where is that version?
There's the Zelda 64. Space World version as well, which is like famous, you know. It looks, when they were saying there's a 3D Zelda coming, you know, before Ocarina of Time came out and they were showing it off at Space World, it was just like you say, it was a tech demo of Link fighting Ganondorf, and that version, you know, never came out. It looks different, the textures are all different, you know, the polygons are different on it and stuff to what we finally got. So, you know, it's always great to see that these like fan recreations, or even better, when it turns out it's still there in the game. So like you say, this Mario Sunshine one, you know, the mapping was there for it, which was really cool. I really like that they recreated the trailer as well, you know, the footage that was shown off. Not only did they recreate the plaza so you could run around it and everything, they then created a trailer, you know, the same trailer. Like you say, the textures are slightly different and stuff like that. But it's really cool that they then spent the time to recreate it as well.
Yeah, one that I remember was Watch Dogs, the notorious E3 trailer that everyone was trying to recreate for ages. And there was an E3 mod that came out later on. Yeah,
it looked totally different, didn't it? The original promised version of that. And we got the game, like, what the hell is this? That doesn't look like the game we were promised. So, it is really cool when modders managed to restore these, you know, these promised games that never were. I did actually love Mario Sunshine. I thought that was wasn't quite the Mario game I think most people are expecting, you know, being set in like a tropical world. I enjoyed that game.
This will make you old, make you feel old, and it made me certainly feel old. I'm fairly certain it was the 20-year anniversary of Mario Sunshine a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah, what, 2002 it came out?
Yeah. Crazy. So, yeah, that made me feel really old. I was like, oh my God, I was like...
Very timely then to release this. So if you want to check it out, I'll put that in our show notes as well. Now we're going to talk about this amazing new project that lets you search through over 91 million files from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, and another lost Mario project. This was something that was meant to come out on the Game Boy Advance, a little preview version of what Mario Kart could have been like on that platform. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Before we do, though, just a quick reminder that the reason we can bring you the Retro Hour podcast each and every week is thanks to you, our incredible patrons. We couldn't do it without them, could we?
No, we couldn't do it without them. And this is absolutely true. And I don't want us to go all the way back to pre-COVID and stuff like that and tell the story of our Patreon launching everything. But long story short, it absolutely 100% comes down to support from our fans and the fact that people, you know, stick with us every week, every month. It's absolutely incredible. And it still blows my mind to this day that people back us and support us. And, you know, as we always say every week, we do like to give something back in the form of our Patreon rewards, which are, Dan, I'm putting you on the spot now.
Oh, we do. Let me just get the Patreon page open.
The tables have turned.
The tables have turned.
Wasn't expecting that. But yeah, I mean, we give back a lot of stuff to our patrons, including, I mean, the normal podcast. We try and get out early when we can. You also get extra content in the patrons-only version of the podcast because we chop all the adverts out and we didn't want to give our patrons a shorter show. So instead, we give you at least two extra news stories just for our patrons every week. Like I mentioned, you get it ad-free too. And also, you will get access to our patrons' area of Discord where we chat away in there all week. We do something that is just my favourite thing every month as well. Last Sunday of the month, we all get together on Google Meets for our patrons' hangout. And if you haven't joined us for one of these before, I mean, how many different topics do we talk about? I mean, if you love the kind of stuff we talk about, obviously retro gaming is a big part of it and computing, but it can go off on all kinds of tangents.
Yeah, it goes off all over the place, talking about horror films, sci-fi, just technology in general, talking about beepers, floppy disks, and just our hobbies and stuff like that. And I always love when we get new people and, you know, they jump on and they show us what retro tech they've recently got, or even anything, you know, any of the regulars I've brought with them, you know, to show off and stuff like that. And you don't have to come on in and get involved and chat away and stuff like that. You can just come on and stay in the corner and just listen to what we're all talking about. You can get involved. We do our best to try and get people, you know, to make people feel welcome and stuff like that. But I look forward to it every single month. You know, like you say, it's just nice to crack a beer with your mates, really.
Yeah, and I love the fact that we just completely nerd out about all kinds of incredible things and see what people are up to as well. I know Matthew is one of our regulars on there, big supporter of the show, and he was showing us how he actually runs basically a little pirate TV station in his house where he can broadcast his old consoles to all his TVs.
Constant so, I mean,
that's
Futurama.
A really ingenious way. Say again?
He's got constant Futurama on the go.
Yeah, he runs like a pretty much he can watch, you know, Games Master and stuff like that by broadcasting it around his house and watch it on his LCRT TVs, which I've been trying to do similarly using a Chromecast and an HDMI adapter, but I didn't think of doing it that way. So it's really cool just to get these ideas. And if you've got systems and you don't know what they are or you need help, it's a bit like a virtual users group. So we do that at the end of every month. And for our gold members and above, you also get an extra podcast every month as well when we do the Retro Hour After Hours. It covers all kinds of retro gaming stuff. So a good time to join us now to get access to all of that. And of course, for joining us on Patreon and helping us keep the lights on and keep this show coming out every Friday, you will get a mention in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, and that is the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And let's give a big welcome to our latest backers.
Hall of Fame!
And let's give a massive thank you to our latest backers. Thank you so much to
Liam Dobson,
Gregory G,
and Neil Thomas, who all backed us on Patreon over the last week. Your support is hugely appreciated. And if you'd like to join the Retro Hour Patrons community, all the details to sign up are on our website right now at theretrohour.com. So our special guest, Bruce Shelley, talking about classics like Railroad Tycoon, Civilization, Age of Empires, he's on the way in the next few minutes. Before that, I mean, this next headline just blew my mind. And I don't know if you find the same, Ravi. You know, when you've got massive collections of old CD-ROMs and floppy disks as well. Do you ever find a situation where you think, I know I've got a file somewhere, but which disk is it on?
I'm out of that situation now, Dan. I'm ashamed to say that I got rid of my big disk collections and CD collections. So this is
Shameful.
Something that I need.
Shame on you, Ravi.
I know Dan's sitting there in a huge archive with all of his old PD discs and stuff like that.
Well, I got rid of them all, then bought them all back again. That's generally what I do with my stuff. But this is a new project and hosted on archive.org, but not actually made by them. This is just fans have made this, and archive.org have hosted it, and it uses their service as well. So archive.org, it's the biggest data preservation project in the world, and they have 11 terabytes of CD-ROM and floppy archives that is now searchable with a new project called Diskmaster. So if you head to this on your web browser, it's diskmaster.textfiles.com. And this is Jason Scott, who's hosting it on his website, who works for archive.org. And also we've had Jason on the podcast before.
Yeah.
Really interesting guy. He's like really into this, isn't he? You know, archiving and preserving stuff.
He's totally into it. He did textfiles.com, which is a BBS archive. It's basically an archive of like all the BBS systems, and there's lots of mad stuff on there. And this looks like it's got a hell of a lot of mad stuff. But also, what he does with all of his sites, textfiles.com was a great example of that. Is he makes it so it can work on old browsers. And this site is minimal. It's got no CSS. It's got none of that fancy modern stuff. And
No tracking.
Nothing like that. And the best thing I like about it is he's got browser compatibility, and he's got good. And the first browser is AWeb for the Amiga. He's got Netscape Communicator in there as well. And he's saying, oh, you know, bad support for like Netscape 1.0 and Mosaic and stuff. So he's really, you know, looking.
Which is fair enough.
Yeah, which is fair enough. But he's really thinking this could be something used on old machines that are connected to the internet. And you have the ability to basically search through like thousands of CD-ROMs and, you know, hundreds of thousands of images and files and all sorts of stuff. There's going to be like music in there. There'll be crazy samples. I'm sure there'll be like maps and levels for games. There's also a few X-rated things in there, of course.
There are a lot of X-rated things in there. Randomly came across a few.
Yeah. And it's just a full collection of that kind of time period. Like I was just looking for it now, and there's like 17-bit software on there. There's all these kind of PD houses and stuff like that. So this is an absolutely amazing program. Website, and if you had this and you had like frogfind.com as well and 68k news, you're in absolute heaven, because you can, you know, get the latest news, search on Google, and also like, you know, download some old mad stuff.
And they've even, I mean, yeah, there's stuff on there from, you know, old CD-ROM collections, a lot of public domain shareware. I mean, a lot of people are actually commenting who've found things that they might have had on a CD-ROM, you know, back in the 90s they forgot about or couldn't find. They managed to track it down using this. But also they've done some file conversion as well on the back end. I've noticed that Amiga DMS files, it automatically converts them to ADF.
Oh, that's
which
sweet.
Is a format that, you know, which generally used on the Amiga for disk imaging now. You can search for like, you know, MIDI music files or Amiga mods, and they'll play directly in your web browser today without any extra tools. So it's converting them on the fly as well. So there's even stuff like old fonts are found on here as well, or music software. A lot of user-generated data, and they're updating this every day at the moment. So I tried it a bit earlier on. The search engine function of it was pretty slow, but they're doing a lot of back-end stuff to make that quicker. And apparently it's already analyzed around 7,000 CD-ROMs, and they're looking to do another 8,000 very soon as well. So it just seems like a really simple way. And, you know, when they've eventually finished this project, it'll really be a way to, I imagine, kind of search every release of, you know, these compilations and utility discs and that from back in the day, like over 30 years of software and collections.
Maybe they'll have native programs, like, so you could somehow connect like an FTP and just mount it or just download it or, you know, get a disk file like that quickly. And that could be amazing, you know, having this huge archive just at the click of your fingers. I think it's amazing to do it in the browser already, but just imagine a native app for like, you know, the Amiga or something like that.
And it was cool because, I mean, I used to get all those magazine cover CD-ROMs and stuff like that. And not everything on those was uploaded to the internet, or if it was, a lot of those websites don't exist today. So without services like this, it would be lost forever.
Oh, yeah, that's really where archive.org shines. Like, you know, the Wayback Machine is just beautiful. Text files is beautiful. And this is just another addition to that whole amazing thing. And, you know, I just love stuff like this.
And it's even got a view counter on there as well. So that's pretty cool. Little hit counter,
old school tribute there.
Yeah. So at discmaster.textfiles.com, it will work in most of your retro browsers as well. If you want to fire up Netscape on Windows 95 and check it out, sure it'll work. Now, we're talking about kind of unreleased Nintendo things. What about this? Now, were you a fan of Mario Kart on the Game Boy back in the day? Was it Super Circuit, the one that came out on the Game Boy Advance?
Yeah, Super Circuit in 2001 for the GBA was like the ultimate game at my school. It was the game everybody got with the GBA. And, you know, it was cool. I want to say it was very similar to the Super Nintendo version, but it probably was closer to the N64 version, to be perfectly honest. It was a real...
Wasn't it like Mode 7, didn't it? It had those Mode 7
graphics.
Yeah,
it was a real kind of like, you know, it was early in the GBA. I think it was might have been one of the release games, or it was very early. It was 2001, but it never got a follow-up. There was Mario Kart 7 for the DS, but it, you know, never got like Super Circuit kind of sits on its own in the Mario Kart series. But I never heard of this game. But this is a failed kind of pitch attempt to Nintendo from a German studio called Daenerys Entertainment Software, which has been kind of dug up by the Nintendo preservation website, Forest of Illusion, who we've spoke about quite a few times before.
Pretty much every week.
Every week. Mario Kart Double XL, the tech demo, which is very classic GBA looking, but very different to kind of like traditional Mario Kart, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there is a video you can watch, and this is something that it's been known about this. It's kind of been very famous, but no one's been able to play it. And it was actually from Manfred Trenz, who was the guy who made Turrican back in the day. Very famous game. And it kind of shows a dual playfield adjustable view engine of Mario. He doesn't move. He's very wooden and everything. But really, it was just a demo to Nintendo of kind of their
scaling. He actually looks
scaling.
Like a puppet. Funny enough that you say he does actually, very wooden. Yeah.
Slightly creepy looking, actually, I would say. But he pitches it to Nintendo, and it's got quite an interesting history because apparently this started as a racing game called the R3D demo that was, and I think there's some assets from the PlayStation in there as well, a PlayStation game called Moor Hunt Kart, which Daenerys also helped develop back in the day too. So really they went to Nintendo, and I imagine this was in 2004, so they were probably pitching this as a successor for you know, the Game Boy Advance to be the next Mario Kart game on there, which obviously didn't happen in the end. But now it's finally available. You can play this very short kind of trailer if you go to Forest of Illusion's website. It is just a tech demo, but there are some interesting things to look at here. So you can go down and kind of read some of the comments that were made on the code by Manfred himself, kind of talking about, you know, the game's content, a bit of an explanation as to why he's done certain things and how the final version would work too. And you've really just got one single track. There's just Mario going around. You've got no enemies or anything like that. There's a lap counter too, but you can't go to the next lap after you cross the finish line. There's coins on there. You can't get them. And, you know, you don't slow down by hitting anything. But it's an interesting look at what could have been. And you can now actually play this and download it, and you'll play it in a GBA emulator if you want to see this tech demo.
Interestingly, I wouldn't say this game, but the development of this game, after it was turned down by Nintendo, actually went on to make the Crazy Frog game for the Game Boy Advance.
Ding, 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 ding,
oh, he's got it ready.
Please, turn it off.
It hasn't got any less annoying in 15 years, has it?
God, I went to a nightclub. I was in Africa, and Crazy Frog was like all over Europe and really popular. And there was this like reggae dance, which was the Crazy Frog. But they all thought it was really cool. And I was in the middle of the club and the whole club was like, brum, 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 brum. And I was just like, God, this is hell.
What's happening?
Yeah, so they actually went on to be, the Crazy Frog racing game actually kind of used some of the engine that would have been in Mario Kart XXL. What a horrible fate for what could have been a really good Mario Kart game on the GBA. But it's always cool to kind of get a look at, you know, what could have been, isn't it? Like I mentioned before. Yeah. So that is available to play right now. If you want to check it out, I'll link that up. And the rest of the stories, you'll find them all in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, just before we chat to this week's special guest, Bruce Shelley, let's take a quick moment to give a big thank you to a regular supporter of the Retro Hour podcast. And this is our sponsor, BetterHelp. Now, we've always talked about, we talk about the fun side of life. We talk about gaming, which is a bit of escapism, isn't it, from everything that's going on in the world. And we know that a lot of people are going through a tough time at the moment. And we really think that it's important to talk about this stuff as well, because everyone's got things going on. And sometimes it's important to think of solutions, isn't it? You know, how can we get a different mindset?
Yeah, 100%. And sometimes, you know, just reaching out to somebody professional, whether it's over the phone, whether it's just on text, whether it's on text chat, you know, on your phone or on your computer or anything like that, it does an absolute wonder, you know, to actually just kind of open up and talk to somebody about it. And I'm a huge advocate, you know, for mental health awareness and kind of looking after your brain. And sometimes there doesn't have to be an issue. There doesn't have to be any sort of diagnosis or anything like that. I'm a strong believer in sometimes when we get sick or we get ill or we get poorly, that can happen in our mind as well. And, you know, there can be something that affects us or something that isn't affecting us and you're just in a low mood. But 100%, you've got to reach out and you've got to talk to people about these things, because sometimes you just end up focusing on the problem instead of the solution. And reaching out for places like BetterHelp, they can help you through that.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned a really good point there as well, that, you know, when you find a solution, it's an amazing feeling. And a therapist can help you be a better problem solver, making it easy to accomplish your goals, no matter how big or small they are as well. And if you've ever thought of giving therapy a try, this is really affordable too. And I think that's been a big misconception, that therapy is only for, like, you know, the rich and famous and everything. This is so affordable. And not only is it affordable, it's very convenient too. You get matched with a therapist after filling out a brief survey, and you can do this either on a webcam, you can just do it on text, like you mentioned, just audio, and they will connect you to someone too. So you can unload stress, heal your emotions, help with anxiety and depression as well. So if you'd like to be a better problem solver, BetterHelp can get you there. And of course, we've got you a unique code to use, so they know that we have sent you, and you'll get 10% off your first month as well. So a really good time to give it a try. If you just want to talk to someone and help become a better problem solver, head to this website right now. It's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/retro. BetterHelp.com/retro. And a big thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp, for their support of our show. Okay, next, time to talk to this week's special guest, getting the inside story on classics like Railroad Tycoon, Civilization, Age of Empires, and lots more with Bruce Shelley. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with gaming legend Bruce Shelley. And we're going to talk about Railroad Tycoon, Civilization, and Age of the Empires, which I just absolutely love. One of my favourite titles. And we start the podcast with the same question every single time. And that was, like, what was the first gaming experience that really hooked you when you were younger?
Yes. Hello. Thinking about this, I played a lot of games as a child and they were fun. And I got really into that. But well, I was at the beach. I was a teenager. I was at the beach with my family, and we had a rainy, cloudy day. We went into town, and I bought a board game called 1914 from Avalon Hill. It was like, I liked history, and here's a game that talked about the first parts of World War One. It was a, you know, complicated game, not for everybody probably, but I found it intriguing. And I, after I played that and tried that by myself, I started looking for more of the games that they made. And that sort of got me on the path to becoming eventually a game designer. You know, 15 or 16 years later, I'd actually go to work for that company.
Yeah, Avalon Hill seemed really prolific in kind of producing games. We've had a lot of people that have talked about them in the past and, you know, how it influenced them for gaming. Were you into other titles by them, and were you reading many novels and stuff at the time?
Well, like I said, I liked history. So I think what was cool about those games is a history book would come with maps, usually, and it was a historical campaign or a battle book or something. And then the maps would be maybe on the inside covers. But what the games did was take those maps off the back covers and put markers on the map representing all the units. Then you would, instead of just reading about the battle, you could refight the battle and from the perspective of the two opponents, usually two, and learn much more about the situation, what they're dealing with, and how factors like terrain or supplies or reinforcements affected the situation. So it was just an add-on to an expansion of the learning experience that a book would normally give me. And so I found it very intriguing, and I kept looking for more. I bought many more of their games, and I ended up subscribing to a magazine, their magazine, The General. And then it was another magazine we published in New York City called Strategy Tactics Magazine. Publish the game every issue, every six times a year. And that all through college, especially when I was home, not so much when I was away at school, but when I was home, that was something I did in the summer. And, I just got into it. I just really enjoyed that aspect of making history come alive a little more.
And if you think about those concepts, like, you know, magazine culture, kind of add-ons to games, replayability factor, and stuff like that, it actually really works with modern gaming, and it's kind of like that model's moved on a bit.
Yeah, it's certainly a technology change. You know, there were no computer games in the 60s when I was doing that, computer games just came along somewhat later for sure, and it's been an incredible expansion of the possibilities of computer games.
Well, grad school, you're in a war game club as well. And I was just wondering how important was like that multiplayer aspect and the gaming community to you back then?
Well, it was great to have people to play games with. I didn't really have get people to play with. I didn't know that there was communities or groups that played board games at the time. When I got to the University of Virginia, they had a game club that met on Friday nights, and I started showing up, and there was like people in town, undergraduates, graduate students, college, you know, faculty were all mixed into this group, you know, all ages and all different kinds of games were played. We certainly, there were a group of some of us who played those more hardcore war games, but there was a D&D had started. So there was a D&D group playing Dungeons and Dragons. What I found particularly interesting was that we started playing more social multiplayer games, you know, before Settlers of Catan, but of that style of game. I remember a game called Titan we played quite a bit. And I really enjoyed the social aspect, and I enjoyed the games. I could play and enjoy the more, you know, more strict hardcore games, like maybe one-on-one. But I also found that I really enjoyed playing the multiplayer games with a bunch of people or three or four or five people. And the social aspect of that, it was a really a fun experience, not just the challenge of learning about the historical situation presented by a game.
And there was always a lot of personality that was put into the games as well. Like I remember seeing like some, you know, a good dungeon master would make a kind of gripping game and stuff. Did you start adding like different concepts and ideas into your games?
I was more, when it came to RPG role-playing games, I was more a player. I didn't take an active role as a dungeon master. We had really good ones. And I don't know if you knew the story, but one of the dungeon masters was on his way to the West Point Military Academy to teach history. And he took Dungeons and Dragons and started modifying it, turning into a Lord of the Rings Middle Earth role playing game. And we played that. And that was cool because I didn't know the story behind D&D, but I knew the story of the Lord of the Rings. And so making the Lord of the, you know, Middle Earth come alive in a role playing game was fun. And what happened is he graduated, finally went off to the military academy to teach. And one of the other fellows in the club took over as a game master. And he was very interested in that. He made beautiful maps and created adventures. And we eventually started within the game club, we started a company called Iron Crown Enterprises, and we wrote to the Tolkien family, and we thought we had permission to make role-playing games based in Middle-earth. So for 20 years or so, Iron Crown Enterprises was publishing Middle-earth role-playing based on, it was D&D competitor based in Middle-earth. And that was my first experience going to trade shows, selling those products, writing. That was my first real game-making experience, in a sense, is writing and helping with that, getting that started.
So would that kind of be like coming up with the game concepts, designing it from scratch and, like, as you said, doing mapping and art and related stuff around it? Was there like a kind of a industrial process that you guys had?
Yeah, we had the president of the company, Pete Fallon, was really good at the maps and this stuff. And there was a couple other people really into the culture, Middle Earth culture. I mean, I was on the edge of that. I mean, I read The Lord of the Rings in the '60s, early '60s. And I was very interested in this, stories and stuff. I liked fantasy and science fiction stuff to read, but this was really up there. Like, I was still a traditional historian player in many ways. And this was just one of the things I was involved in, but it was a business and I had some time on my hands and I started helping. I was very active in helping them. I did a lot of writing in terms of editing and writing the rules. It was not so much the creative aspect of it. I don't remember writing any adventures, for example. And then, the company that published Strategy and Tactics magazine had was looking for someone to come up there and help them. And by now I had met some of those guys at a trade show and I'd already done some free work for them about Civil War games. I went over to the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia and walked the battlefields and I looked at the library at the university. I looked at the official records of the Civil War and read accounts of the battle. So I gave a lot of input on a game they were building and they recognized that. And I had some other experience. So they offered me a job in New York. And I thought that before I got a real job, coming out of school, I would try to make a living in the game industry. And I actually went up to New York and worked there in downtown Manhattan for several months, making the kind of games that first got me going. And that was like the 1914 game from Avalon Hill. I was actually working for Strategy and Tactics magazine. And that was, quite an adventure.
Did you feel like you had to be very accurate with historical stuff, but fantasy gave you a bit more kind of freedom and a bit more freedom of expression?
I think at the time that was true. That's why I did all that research in the library, because I thought that they made some mistakes, that the designer of the game had made some mistakes in terms of the order of battle, who was actually there and what actually happened, and distances involved, and the map was a little inaccurate. So at the time, I thought, I think it was important that the historic game, anyway, a game on history, a historical episode, the starting points and the people acting should be legitimate. It should be accurate so that you have a good representation of the chance of the choices that were made at the time, what happened. If you start messing around with the map, then you don't have an accurate situation. You're not going to really learn what happened or have faced the same decisions. So I thought accuracy in a historic game was important. I wasn't so much of a fantasy gamer other than I participated. I wasn't making those. So I didn't deal with the freedom that came with being in a fantasy world.
Well, you mentioned you started working with Avalon Hill, and they were really pioneers in that kind of area. What were some of your favorite titles and why?
The SBI company in New York was essentially going out of business. They couldn't keep me. I was just an intern for 3 months. And so when I knew I wasn't keeping that job, I started writing to other companies that I knew. And Avalon Hill was one I wrote to. And it took a while, but they finally had me in for an interview and offered me a job. And my first my job there at first was to take games from a company. They'd also bought the inventory of a game company called Victory Games out of New York City or New York area. And they asked me to go through their library of products and what would I choose to remake in the Avalon Hill style. And after I'd been there a while, I was given the free, I would go out and find other games that I thought we should make. And so I did a game from Francis Tresham you may know, in Great Britain. He did a railroad game called 1829, which I loved. And I got him to work on an 1830 game about American railroads. I was responsible for that for Avalon Hill. I really liked that game. There was a game called Britannia that was about the early invasions of Great Britain, all the people that came into Britain, and that was published by someone else, but it was going out of print, and I talked to the company, they're getting that, or maybe they just gave it to me. I don't remember how I got it, but I redid the Britannia game for Avalon Hill, and there were several others like that. B-17, Queen of the Skies, maybe another one. Can't remember all of them. But that was for after we got through the Victory games, I had some freedom to work on other products and go find other games that we could redo or buy. Or I only invented a few games from scratch for Avalon Hill. One was we had a trivia game. There was a game, Trivia Pursuit was very popular. And our company wanted to do a trivia game. So we got together in a room and talked about how we could remake a trivia game. And we went off to our offices and made a trivia game design real quick. And I came back and mine was selected as the one they would publish. And then they just got questions, very difficult trivia questions from somebody that published as a trivial game. I remember that I did a game called, I designed a game called Patton's Best about the 4th Armored Division that drove across World War France and into Europe. And I did that as a solitaire game because I was thinking by this time I need to get into computer games because that looked like the future. I thought a solitaire game would help demonstrate my understanding of how to make a computer game because they were pretty much all solitaire games at that time.
Well, what was the first kind of example of a computer game that you, of a board game that turned into a computer game that you saw that really impressed you? And did you have any like experience of text adventures or titles like that?
I played those. Yeah, I was part of a handful of friends that we would get together and we were living in Baltimore at this time. And I think Friday night was game night at one friend's house. We played a lot of board games and we played text adventures on a lot. I can't remember how we did it on TV or something. I remember that, but we did a lot of those. And they were fun. The one that captured my attention was called Pirates, Sid Meier's Pirates. Because when I'm working in Baltimore for Avalon Hill, at some point in 1987, they asked me to move over to their computer game division, and I started helping them make computer games. They were all done out of house by individuals, usually, and they'd send us the prototypes, and we'd work, and I'd have to make it work as a game some way. I remember the first PC game I worked on had four colors, white, black, cyan, and magenta. Those are the four colors we had to work with, and I think it was a remake of a board game called Wooden Ships and Iron Man, if I remember correctly. And I thought this was still the future, and I was interested in getting involved in this. But I was part of Avalon Hill. I wasn't part of Avalon Hill's computer game group, as I recall. And then I found out the friend of mine asked me to suggest that I play this Pirates game. He had it on an early game machine, a Commodore or something. And I went to his house. We played Pirates. And I said, wow, this is really cool. I thought right away, this is the future, a big part of the future of gaming is computer games like this, because it was a great story adventure. I really enjoyed playing it. And I find out that the company that made that is on the north side, not too far from where I was working already. It was in Baltimore, not too far away. So I started talking to them about a possibility of a job. And it took a while, in part. And I told him, I said, look, you've got programmers and artists. You don't have anybody who's actually made games here yet. I mean, I sort of was pushing it. But eventually they had me over for an interview. They got to the point where they wanted more people. And they had me for an interview, and they offered me a job the next day. And I started working. That was when I started working for MicroProse in Hunt Valley, Maryland.
I was wondering, had you any experience before with like programming or computer graphics or anything like that?
No. I mean, I never learned how to program. It was not really an option when I was an undergraduate that I recall, or it wasn't something that interested me. So I think, I'm an anomaly in a sense that I've been involved in computer games now since 1987 and games in general since 1980, but I never was a programmer. But I think, in this industry, there's a lot of specialties, and design is one of them, you don't have to program to be a designer. I mean, my view of the design, I think, was explained by a friend named Greg Kostikian. He said, in his view, our desire was to imagine in our heads how the game is, envision how the game is supposed to look and play on screen, what is supposed to be happening. And then we have to translate that vision to the people, explain that vision, communicate that vision to the people who are actually going to make it, which will be the art team, programming team, the sound effects team. And so we're the holders of the vision and the communicators of the vision. And then we have to set a lot. There's a lot of writing involved, or a lot of like decision making about what's the art style, what the technology you're going to deal with, the systems, how resources are going to be gathered, how they're going to be spent, what you buy. There's an awful lot of other stuff. So there's plenty of room. The Age of Empires games, for example, might have had as many as, you know, half a dozen to 10 designers doing scenarios and things like that that didn't involve any programming. It was plenty of work.
I think that's really interesting, because that's like, you know, in the UK, we had a lot of people that were, you know, designing, creating, programming, doing the whole works on a single game. And for MicroProse, that must have been quite pioneering to have, you know, two designers that were actually there just for the kind of design role.
Yeah, we did have people whose job was just design, and that was new, I think relatively new in the industry. And we also had Sid Meier, who was an old school guy who had done it all himself, you know, along the way. But eventually we got to the point where we would support him. I was an assistant designer for him on several games. We had an art lead on Railroad Tycoon, who did most of the art, you know, Sid didn't put together. And, you know, and as the teams got for Civilization, we got some more additional help in that regard. And then, of course, now I'm working with a studio here in Texas. I just retired from, and they got like, you know, dozen artists on a project and a dozen programmers on a project, and you know, we have a sound engineer, you know, so there's much bigger teams. Of course, we're overwhelmed by some of these other teams in the country that have hundreds of people making games, 50 programmers, 50 artists on a game, you know. So I transitioned from the day when it was like one guy did it all to now we have hundreds doing the product.
I was going to say, with Railroad Tycoon as well, that must have been a direct influence from 1830 railroads and robber barons and what you mentioned earlier. Was it kind of influenced by those older board game titles? And why did kind of railroads fascinate you?
Okay, so let's be clear. I mean, Sid Meier was the designer and programmer of 1830. I was his assistant. And we did play the railroad game that I'd worked on, 1830. We played 1829 as well. We might have played other railroad games at the time. I swear I had a collection of railroad games. I was interested in railroad. So I think he was inspired by those games. But what really inspired him was that he loved trains, model trains as a child. He was born in Switzerland, grew up there, and he came to the U.S. early on. But he had a model train for Christmas and stuff like that. And his vision was making, I think it wasn't making 1830 come alive. It was making sort of like the railroad, the model railroad come alive. And he went off on a vacation. I remember this. And he came back after 2 weeks at the beach somewhere. And he had a prototype for Railroad Tycoon. And he asked me to play it. And we talked about it. And we messed around with that for maybe a week or a month or so. Kept changing it, adding in, you know, the different aspects of the game, picking up Fargo's, building up towns, building up industries. And we went off for a lunch. You know, it was really funny. He and I went together to lunch up near the shopping mall near our office. He says, "Well, I want to stop working on this spy game and start working on the railroad game. What do you think of that idea? I mean, what do you think of stop?" And I said, "Absolutely, the railroad game. It's so exciting. I'm really excited about it. The spy game is fine, but this is the one I really like to work on." So that was the decision. We went back to the office and they told management that we're going to do this railroad game and maybe not the spy game right for a while. And he was in a position where he could make that decision. And so we worked on Railroad Tycoon until it was done.
That's great that they kind of had the confidence to do that and also, you know, take you guys up on it. I was wondering as well, like board games as well, they had huge documentation and booklets with them, and Railroad Tycoon did as well, and that kind of related to history and built up a narrative. Was that really important in those titles?
I thought it was. I mean, I thought it was a nice grounding in we wanted to build a railroad game, we had one of the themes of the game was that the railroads would evolve. You know, you would go through time and that steam engines would turn into diesel engines and, you know, the industries would change a little bit. And so one of my jobs was to research the evolution of the steam engine and pick particular engines that would appear in the game, that was fun. Years later, I got to go to the York Railway Museum in York, England, and I got to see some of the locomotives that I'd actually chosen to be in the game. I also got to do the maps. And so it was my job. So I got to pick the towns. My grandfather's hometown is in Elkhart, Indiana. That's on the map, whereas a bigger city nearby, South Bend, is not. You know, so I got to do that kind of stuff. And I had to pick, you know, a map, build the maps. And, you know, it was fun. I mean, I read tons about the origins. I'd already read a lot about the origins of railroading when I was doing 1830 in America. So this just built on that research. I'd already had a library of books that I acquired or could refer to. And it all came together. We did two trips doing railroad tech. And we went to a railroad museum in Pennsylvania and rode a steam engine, went to their museum, looked at stuff. And that was Sid and Max Remington, the artist, and myself. The three of us went there, spent the day there looking at railroad stuff. Then we went to Washington, D.C., went to the went to the Smithsonian Institution, and went to a train store. We did two field trips where we just immersed ourselves in railroading. And that was unusual for a game design group, but that was really fun and got our juices going for let's get this project going. You know, that was fun.
Yeah, that sounds amazing, going on a railroad kind of trip. I think that manuals and stuff nowadays, you know, you get a PDF or you get a walkthrough or a guide, and it was a whole extra part of immersion with the games then, and an extra element that seems to have kind of disappeared off. Do you think we'll start to see more manuals in like modern games again, or and the text?
My guess is no. You know, it's much easier to, you know, that's an expense, you know, to write it and to have it printed. I mean, I remember I wrote those manuals, the manuals for those games, Railroad Tycoon, Civilization, and the other game, a couple other games. So, you know, that was work. And then we had to work with somebody in-house to get them printed and laid out. You know, I mean, I was working at Avalon Hill. I laid out those books, those manuals myself. I wrote a lot of manuals. And I'd write the copy on the back of the box, you know, the advertising copy. At least somebody got to do that professionally for Microprose, but I was doing it for Avalon Hill. But, you know, that was a lot of expense that you can get rid of the staff down the hallway who's printing but laying out the printing and sending off their printer by doing it all electronically. I think that's got to be true. I don't think that people, I don't know, the marketing people, the sales people, I used to make a decision that the expense of making those manuals that we used to write are not worth whatever they bring to the product. So I think that those are gone in our lifetime.
Yeah, maybe you need like special editions or something like that.
I think there's another factor involved here, and that is that the fans that really like your game will do that on their own to some extent. I mean, I know when we were building games later on that there was a lot of opportunity to mod your game, build your own scenarios or campaigns. And people loved doing that. And it added an incredible amount of added value to the product you bought. And you could download all this extra information and value from people who just got excited about the game. And that added some work for you.
Well, you mentioned that Civilization, and it's one of my absolute favorite titles. I was wondering, what was it like when you first saw a kind of running demo of Civilization and really got the concept?
Yes, I remember exactly. I mean, I was May of 1990, and the way Sid and I would work, I worked for him, is that he would give me a version of a game and I'd play it for a while. And then I'd go down to his office. We'd sit there sometimes for hours and he'd play it on screen. We'd talk about it. We'd make, you know, what we like, what we didn't like, what would be cool to add here and that kind of stuff. It was a very iterative process. And one day, you know, we had played a board game called Civilization. We played another game called Empire Deluxe. And at one point he says, what would you change about Empire Deluxe? Give me a list of 10 things you would change about Empire Deluxe if we were going to rebuild that game. And I sat down and I thought about it for a while. I actually gave him, if I remember, I gave him like 12 things that would change, trying to be a star. And so we talked about it quite a bit, and he would prototype. He always had a handful of prototypes on his machine that he was fooling around with. And then one day in May of 1990, he gave me a floppy disk and he says, try this. This might be our Civilization game. And I saved that disk, you know, for years. I had that in my stuff. And I finally, I was going to donate it to a museum, and Sid asked me to have it back. So I gave it back to him and he got it going again. It was not a turn-based game. It was real time. It was more set in ancient times like prehistoric times. And, you know, it was more time in that period, as I recall. And I mean, I knew right away. I said, well, this is really cool. You know, this is going to be great. You know, I was just very impressed. And from that day on, we started working on Civilization a little bit. But what happened was the manager of the company wanted that spy game that we had never finished. And they told me I could not work on Civilization or Railroad Tycoon 2 or whatever until we finished that spy game. And so Sid reluctantly said, okay, let's finish the spy game. We got that done. And then we were given permission to go full blast on Civilization. Every day I would get a version and I'd play it. And then we'd sit down and talk about it for a couple hours. And then he'd get a new version going and we'd play it some more. And that went on day after day after day after day. He wouldn't let anybody else play it except me for months. And guys were coming into my office, or friends, or girls and guys were coming in and say, what is going on with this game? And they were all interested. They watched me play, or they talked to Sid about it. He wouldn't let anybody else play. He just wanted to keep it tight. You know, he didn't want to have a lot of feedback that he didn't want to deal with. So he relied on me to be there, everybody. And my tastes were like, you know, good enough for him. And then finally he said, okay, we're making this game. This is going to be the thing. And by then I knew we really had a special game on our hands. So I was thinking, I'm sitting in a studio or little office in North Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm working on a game that's going to blow people away. I think it's really going to be great.
I think one of the amazing things about Civilization is, as we mentioned before, replayability and the fact that, you know, you could generate those landscapes, but also you could play as any combination of a civilization, and you could kind of choose the path of the way you wanted to play. Was that a massively deliberate move? And also, did anybody kind of think, oh, that will affect sales? Like,
I don't remember anybody worrying about sales. I mean, I know one of my friends, still a friend today, who's got his own game company now, is a salesman, Glenn Drover, Mosaic Games or Forbidden Games. And he kept it. Every time he was in a meeting, he came to meetings he was out of town. He'd come in and said, oh, I got to see this game. Tell me what's going on. He was so fascinated with it. I think everybody embraced the idea that there was different cultures in the game, that they played maybe a little differently. Those were things we borrowed when we started doing Age of Empires. You know, we wanted different cultures. We wanted them to be a little bit unique, have special power that only they had, you know, and people would get their favorites and want to play only as that person. I think that was deliberate, and I think it was a very positive thing.
Yeah, it's a great move, and they've still kind of stayed on till this day in all of those kind of strategy games. I was wondering, were there any features of Civilization that you would like to see, or anything that got removed before the final version?
Oh gosh, you know, we're talking 30 years ago, at least. You know, there's been so many versions of Civilization that have come out now. I think it's in the 6th edition, right? I think we made some mistakes in the first game. There was ways to cheat that we discovered later, and that had to be fixed. But we didn't, I think it was, a mistake that Ollie was the only playtester for so long. And I learned from that, I drew away the lesson that we need to play our games a lot. And everywhere I've worked since, when we started Ensemble, it was like mandatory. Everybody in the company has to play. And at least once a week. And we hired full-time testers for Age 2. And we tried to hire some of the best players were very good players who had extent, you know, that were willing to do that and work for us to play. And that I think made a difference in our games, you know, being a higher quality the first time out of the box. And I took a lesson away that we did. We don't think we played the first version of Civilization enough.
You then moved into doing strategy guides as well. And I guess that wasn't a massive industry at the time, but now you look at it and the strategy guides are huge, and tips and techniques and, you know, even the best way of kind of speed running a game. What kind of experiences did you learn doing that?
What happened was I got married, and my wife was an executive in the banking industry, and she was offered a really great job in the Chicago area, making a lot more money than a game designer at MicroProse. So we had to go. We had just had to do it. And so I left the company, and after like almost 5 years, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but people had written strategy guides about Railroad Tycoon, I think, and certainly Civilization. So I wrote to the company. I met their writers and stuff, and I talked with the company. I said, I'm looking for something to do, you know, when I'm going to move to the Midwest. And I said, would you consider having me write some of these books? And they said, absolutely. We'd love to have a guy who'd actually make games write these books. So they gave me a contract to write so many books. And I did. I think I ended up doing five or six books for different games, including the colonization book for Brian Reynolds did a game called Colonization about the come out of the Civilization universe. And that was an interesting experience. I learned a lot writing. That was very useful. It's funny for a guy who took science in college because he didn't want to write paper, ended up writing five or six books. And then something else came along and I got involved with Tony Goodman down in Dallas making games. And there's a story there if you want to hear it, but I haven't gone back to writing books. It was experience. I learned a little bit about writing, but I don't think I learned a lot about games.
I love that you mentioned Colonization as well, because I was absolutely hooked to that title. Really interesting one, that one.
Yeah, working on that book was fun because I knew everybody working on it. They were all my ex-colleagues, so I was involved in the process. That book was written as the game was made. It wasn't written after the game was made. It was written during the making of the game. So I had more insight about the decisions were made because I was involved when they were making them. I was playing the game, giving feedback, and myself as it was developed. So that was a really sweet spot to be for a guy who was going to write a book about how to play the game. I've been playing it since it was a concept.
Well, in 1995, you co-founded Ensemble Studios, and that was with a good school friend, Tony Goodman. What was it like kind of re-entering the industry with all the technological changes that had happened?
It wasn't that big a change because I had been, writing these books, I'd stayed connected to the game industry. I was playing, like I said, I had to write about four or five games. So, I can't remember now, but I was getting software and dealing with game developers. So I was sort of in the game industry, but on the periphery. I wasn't making them, but I was still seeing the changes. You know, I had to buy a pretty good computer to play them all. I kept in touch. And then Tony Goodman was the president of Ensemble. He had been a kid in the game club at UVA way back. And his father was on the faculty at the university, and he and his brother Rick were in the game club. And I guess I made an impression on him, and he knew what I was doing. He knew I'd gone into the game industry. And he called me up out of nowhere in 94 or 95 and started talking about what's involved in making computer games, because I've got a business here that's got a lot of programmers and they want to make computer games, and I'm thinking about doing it. And finally, he asked me to come down and meet him. And I wasn't a founder of the studio. I was like employee number four, but it was started by Tony and his business partners. I was an employee, but I was one of the first.
Well, what was the difference in culture in Ensemble compared to, MicroProse?
Well, I think the cultures were pretty similar. Everybody was passionate about making games, and I loved the idea and was really into them and was excited about what their job was. You know, got really interested in the projects we were making. Ensemble was not, MicroProse was a full-scale production company. I mean, they did everything soup to nuts. You know, we made the game at one end of the building, and they were sold and marketed down the other end of the building. So every step in the process from concept to customer was in that building. Whereas Ensemble was just a development studio. We had to find a partner to publish our game. We were the game experts. We were building the software, but we needed marketing and publishing and everything to come from some other source. And eventually we needed to get financing from other source. You know, MicroProse was self-sufficient. We were Tony put up the money, his other company, and he and his partners put up the money to keep us going for a while. But to finish that game, we were going to need a publisher who's going to help pay the bills. And so that was a little different experience.
Well, where did the concept of Age of Empires come from?
One of the other employees, I think ahead of me, Tim Dean, and he was number two or three. He was a big gamer. He played tons of games, and I think he had actually worked in a game company for a brief period. He brought in the Warcraft one day to the office, and he said, this game is really cool. It's doing great, and we should be doing something like this, because our first Ensemble Studio concept was not Age of Empires, it was something else. And we took a look at that, and we played a bunch of it, played a lot of Warcraft. Everybody bought Warcraft and played it. Maybe Command and Conquer as well. And then the idea came to us because Rick Goodman, his brother, and Brian Sullivan, they were designers as well, became designers as well. And we loved the historical games. We all came from that era of board games, historical games. So the idea came together. The vision was let's take the technology of real-time strategy like Warcraft and Command and Conquer and merge it with the economics and historical stuff of civilization, bring and create an RPG, a role-playing game based in a historical context. And so that was the vision for Age of Empires. It was originally called Dawn of Man. That was our name for it when we started going around the country trying to find a publisher.
Yeah, like real-time strategy had, it was out there before, but it really kind of kicked off with the, you know, the power increasing on the computers and titles like Command & Conquer and Warcraft. Was it challenging to kind of, you know, have a full society and implement that at the time and have it all running fast? And, you know, did you have to cut back on some elements?
I don't remember cutting back on. I mean, I'm sure we did because we saved ideas for Age 2. You know, at some point, you know, I tell people making games is kind of like making sausage. You know, at some point you got to stop making it and start selling it. You know, you gotta tie off the sausage and put it in the marketplace. And I think we look back. I mean, we had a sit down after the game was published. It did better than we ever hoped, and we wanted to know what we did right. What was a super sauce? What do we do correct? Because we need to make that happen. You gotta do this again. And we talked about why we think Age was so successful. And one of the simple reasons was when there was like 50 some real-time strategy games in development in 1997, then one of the magazines in America published this article and listed all these games. And of those 50 some games, every one was either based in science fiction or fantasy, following in Warcraft or Command & Conquer, except one. And that was Age of Empires. We had chosen a historic topic for our game, you know, the early civilizations, first civilizations on Earth. And it made us really stand out. We were really different from everything else. And another exercise we did, I don't want to talk about this, but we sat down in a room one day and I said, let's make a list of all the things Warcraft is doing right and great, why it's good, why Command & Conquer is really good, what has got civilization, what the civilization was doing, it was really great. And then we'll make a list over here of things they're not doing. And so the first couple columns were the things we've got to be as good as they are at. And the fourth column is our opportunities, is where we distinguish our game and make it different. And so people are not playing the same game. They're playing something new. And being based in history was a big part of that. And making it sunshine, our game, instead of a dark, forbidding planet was part of that. And, an AI that didn't cheat and randomly generated maps. Those are some of the features that we didn't take the other games were really doing or doing well. And that they could distinguish our game and make it stand out.
And you added a female character into Age of the Empires 2 as well, because it seemed to really appeal to female players. Also, the AI was improved. What kind of other improvements were you aiming for?
Well, I wanted, like I said earlier, I wanted a non-cheating AI. I pushed for that, and I thought that would make a better game. And randomly generated maps would make it replayable. You know, I wanted it endlessly replayable. We had these single player campaigns. So it turns out we gave the players like an incredible number of opportunities. I mean, I would say, maybe I said this later about age two, but I would say that I wanted the most smartest 15-year-old kid, boy or girl in junior high to say, this is my favorite game, play it at a high level. But that would inspire other boys and girls in class to try the game as well. And they could play it differently, but they would all get their money's worth, you know? And I find out my friend talked about playing with his daughter, and they could play it very simply with a very low, the difficulties of AI. You could set it like, I can't lose, which would make it fun for a child to play versus, or a young person to play with their dad or mom. And then you could play it really hard. And, so that would be a challenge for a super player. So we provided an awful lot of different ways to play that game, which would reach out to a broader audience instead of just a hardcore audience or a casual audience. The different audiences of computer games around the world could find a way to play that game, get their money worth, enjoy it, and tell their friends, I really like this game, you should try it. That's what we were shooting for.
Do you think the historical accuracy and kind of help educate people about history as well? Like, I know I certainly learned some stuff from Civilization.
Well, I think historical accuracy is a little strong. I mean, I remember reading an article or seeing an article in a history magazine that said, you know, the history in this game is crazy. It's nothing like real. There's hardly anybody on the earth who's ever heard of Hittites, if they haven't read the Bible or something. And here the Hittites are a team you can play in this game. So I think an overall the history people were enthusiastic because it introduced people to history. And then as the years went by, we would get these letters from people saying, my son was a pretty average student, but then he started playing Age of Empires, and now he's going to the library and getting books about the Roman Empire and this and that and the other thing. And I'm sure, I know that my friends are at Microsoft were very happy with that. I mean, this was software, you know, doing its thing, educating as well as entertaining. And I think they got a big kick out of the fact that their game was, you know, encouraging young people to go learn more about some historic episodes. So our game was an introduction. Yeah, we borrowed from history the things that would make a good game. We left out things like slavery and religion, because we didn't want to be controversial. We wanted to be the Black Plague would not be in H2, for example. But we wanted an entertaining thing that would introduce you to this stuff. I mean, we used to do our research. I remember telling people I did a research in the children's section of the library because it was more generally understood and recognized. They had lots of pictures, which would help us make art. You know, I think when Sid made a speech or a comment years ago that I remember, just the player should have the fun, not the designer, not the artist, not the historian. You know, we wanted the players to have the fun.
I was wondering, was there ever a time period that you would have liked to have done Age of the Empires kind of title on? I always thought a Western kind of would be a pretty interesting one.
Oh, we certainly talked about that kind of stuff. But, you know, those games were big and they took a while to make. Age 1, the first Age took almost, 3 years to make, maybe 2.5. And Age 2 took a couple. Age 3 took several. We redid the city in Age of Empires 3 like a dozen times, the home city, trying to get it to work the way we liked. We spent a lot of time with formations trying to make those work and never got them to work. And so, but we talked about going forward in time. If the company had stayed together and we'd found enough people enthusiastic after 3 Age games and Age of Mythology and a bunch of expansion packs, the guys were a little tired of that. We had other game ideas in the works. And Microsoft decided they wanted us to give up our jobs and so they could do Xbox games. They didn't think we could do an Xbox game to their quality or something like that. Anyway, we were talked about the next iteration would have might have been World War One or something. H2 was a massive game. You know, it was a great period to do a game about, you know, knights and castles and all that kind of stuff. It's perfect. And H3 was, we're getting into gunpowder and long range weapons, and it was more of a challenge. So as the weaponry got longer range, it becomes more of an issue, but it's been resolved. I think people have done pretty good games in a more modern situation.
Well, I thought Age of Mythology as well was great. It must have been fun kind of having those, mythical gods and creatures added in there and all those crazy powers that they could have.
Yeah, that was like a break. You know, we, after Age 2, I think we felt with our people really needed a break from the limitations of a historical game. Even though we play fast and loose with history to make a good game, we did feel constrained. So mythology opened up an awful lot of stuff for us. You know, these gods and powers and mythological creatures, and so it was a lot more fun for. Yeah, artists and musicians and I think it was a lot. It was a nice break from the H story, and it turns out to be. It's funny. I keep running into people who say that actually Age of Mythology is the favorite game we made.
Yeah, it seems really kind of fun. That one does, and I always like those kind of gods and mythology in there as well. I was wondering, have you kept any of your old board games from back in the days that you had?
I do, yeah. Actually, it's like I'm getting to be an older man now. I'm in my 70s and I've got a basement with lots of games that I'm deciding what to do with them. I'm probably going to try and sell them on eBay, or I guess like there's some shops that would buy them all probably. But I do have hundreds of games, hundreds of board games. They just accumulated them. I was a collector. I collected railroad games a little bit. I collected old games I really liked. You know, I've still got some classic old games. I don't know what they would do with them, really.
I was wondering, what was one of your kind of favorite memories of your career then?
I remember the first day we could play AOE on. We would work all day. I was living in Chicago. I come down to Dallas like months and months for a week to work. I was only working part-time for most of Age of Empires 1. And we would play Warcraft in the afternoon. We'd take a break and play Warcraft for an hour just to keep the juices flowing. And then we got to the point where I was pushing very hard to get a prototype of Age of Empires together so we could play it ourselves online. And I remember I was in the office and we played an 8-player game of Age of Empires for the first time. And we played the game to conclusion. It worked, you know, smoothly, you know, whatever. And everybody got out of their chair and ran down the hall. We were all cheering.
That sounds awesome. Well, Bruce, it's been absolutely amazing. And I just want to ask, what are you up to nowadays?
Well, as of June 30th, I retired. I've been working for a small studio in Texas. It's like a third studio I work along a 30-mile stretch of a highway north of Dallas, Texas. It's founded by guys I work with. One of them, Dave Bonger, is the president. He joined Ensemble in 1996. So I've worked with him at three companies over the last, like 26 years. And he's a good friend. And I didn't want to work full time. I just wanted to work. I offered to help him, you know, a little bit if he could use some help. So I've been here since 2015 on a pretty much part-time basis. We've built a bunch of games. Some of our games you can play on Netflix. We did Stranger Things games that are available on Netflix, I believe. And it's been a struggle because we've always had to find financing, and several projects were stopped 2/3 of the way through because the financing stopped. The company was paying for the game, couldn't finish. And we're working on a game now we think is going to be cool. We can't talk about it. And even though I'm retired, I still play it and still sit in some meetings once in a while. But I'm doing genealogy research. My wife and I are going to we bought a second house to get out of winter weather, and working on that, trying to get more exercise and read more, playing games less.
Awesome, Bruce. Well, it's been amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.